We're introducing John Calvin tonight, but before we begin in earnest, I need to just test you to see how much you know before I know how much I need to tell you. So, next slide, David. We want to put John Calvin in context, first of all, in context of the kings and emperors of the day, because that's helpful to us. John Calvin, born in 1509, died in 1564, was a contemporary of this gentleman, who is? That's an easy one, isn't it? Now I need to know all the ladies round him in order. Yes, thank you, David. Henry VIII, so you can see his reign was 1509 to 1547. So over that time, Calvin's life. And it's amazing Henry managed to get through six wives in the time that Calvin was alive. Who was the next king after Henry VIII? Edward VI, yes. And then? Mary. Yes, unless we count Lady Jane Grey, we've missed her out. Okay, David, let's have a look. And you can see that Calvin's life spans right into Elizabeth's life. So if you're thinking about English history, you're thinking about that time and those kings and queens. And then next one, David, in Europe, perhaps names not quite so familiar to us, but they come into the story, as it were. King Francis I of France and Charles V became Holy Roman Emperor in 1519. So you really are perhaps digging back into your European history to get to that point. Okay, next one. Let's put Calvin into the Reformation, in context of the Reformation. Who is the top man, the one on the right here? No. Thank you. Zwingli, yes. So if you press the button, David. Ulrich Zwingli. So you can see he came and brought the Protestant Reformed teaching into Switzerland before Calvin. That's interesting. And this man down here, Martin Luther. Yep, so put him up, David. And you can see again that Luther's life began and the influence of Luther before really John Calvin was any age. And we're going to mention the 95 Theses in 1517 a bit later on, and the wonderfully titled Diet of Worms, which I remember from school days, always made all the boys laugh a little bit. Nothing to do with food. It was a great meeting where Luther stood up, didn't he, and said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." One more date, David, and perhaps not so well known, the opening of the Council of Trent, which, if we think about the Reformation, the Council of Trent was an attempt to reverse the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, that great meeting which attempted to do that. Okay, I've got a couple more questions for you, that's all. Next one. If you walk past these men in the street, which you can do in Geneva, David's been there, walked past. Has anybody else been there? Oh my goodness me, quite a few people have been there. Okay, those of you who have been there, who's the man on the far left? That side?
Peter.
Well, you didn't take much notice when you went there, did you? Okay, David, press the button. That's Farrell. Okay, next one along.
That's Calvin.
That is Calvin, yeah. Next one? No. Beza, yeah, got there eventually, yes. Beza, yep. Yeah. Which, that's okay. Next one. And lastly? Knox. Yes, looks like a Scotsman. Knox. That's right. He's killed his kilt on underneath, so. Okay. Okay, so let's put the next one on my day. Okay, so let's begin in earnest. Our title this evening is a quote from a letter which Calvin wrote to his very good friend William Farrell. My heart as a sacrifice to the Lord. And this talk is designed to be an introduction to the man who God used in such a wonderful way. God entered his heart, made it his dwelling place at the age of 23 or 24, and from that time his life became a sacrifice totally laid out for the Lord Jesus Christ. Now I stress it's an introduction, and I stress a number of things about that. I am not an expert on John Calvin, so if there are questions at the end, please remember that. I am not a Calvin scholar, although I've read quite a bit just recently, and Anne will tell you, got a bit immersed really. Calvin is a very significant figure in Christian history, and especially in relation to Protestant, Reformed, evangelical belief. And I think we all need to have at least an introduction to him, and maybe a more detailed knowledge. And of course this year is the 500th anniversary of his birth. He was born on the 10th of July 1509, so what better time than this year to get to know about him. And I think we will be quite deluged with material about Calvin. Certainly the conferences are full of talks about Calvin and papers on Calvin and so on, and I'm sure in the press we will hear about him in the Christian press. So I thought it would be good for us to get to know something about him. I like this book in particular because it's got pictures in, and we all like pictures, but it's a superb book as a start about Christian history. And Houghton quotes in there an unnamed author where he says this: to omit Calvin from the history of Western civilization is to read history with one eye shut. Now we want to be Christians with both eyes open, historically and theologically. We don't want to be blown about with every wind of doctrine, and it's largely because people have forgotten history and God's work through history that errors come into the church and errors get repeated in the church. So it's important for us to know something about Christian history. And what I want to do then is set out Calvin's life in context and introduce him to you as a man. I want to introduce him to you personally. I don't really want to go into an introduction of his theological thought or into the doctrines that Calvin brought to the fore in his day, although we will mention them, because perhaps we'll do that at another time. It really requires another time to do that. Now, it might not have escaped your notice that this year is the 200th anniversary of somebody else quite famous, at a different end of the scale to Calvin, of course, Darwin, Charles Darwin. And there will be great polemical debates about Darwin and evolution and so on. And we will be deluged with material about Darwin as well, I am sure. And it seems to me that you are either with Darwin or you're against him. And you know, when you start to look at Calvin, you will find that that is very much the case with him too. There are those that hate Calvin and his teaching, as well as those who love and espouse his teaching. You might find this surprising, but if you type John Calvin into Google on your computer, you will find many articles, even complete websites, which are dedicated to anti-Calvin material. Let me just quote one or two for you. This is a website, JesusIsSaviour.com. And there's a heading, Calvinism is not biblical doctrine. And I quote, Calvin was a heretic who taught that God predestines men to salvation. Calvin taught selective salvation, where God selects who will be saved and who will not. And these are satanic heresies. Calvin also taught irresistible grace, where God forces a person to be saved. Now you'll see immediately that the vitriol against Calvin is born of a fundamental misunderstanding of Scripture. And that's not an isolated case. There are those also who misunderstand and misrepresent his great work of reform in Geneva. There's a site called BibleLife.org, and that has an article called Calvin's Reign of Terror. And this is what it says, or part of what it says. Calvin forced the citizens of Geneva to attend church services under a heavy threat of punishment. Since Calvinism falsely teaches that God forces the elect to believe, it is no wonder that Calvin thought he could also force the citizens of Geneva to all become the elect. Not becoming one of the elect was punishable by death or expulsion from Geneva. Calvin exercised forced regeneration on the citizens of Geneva because that is what his theology teaches. And when you read these sites, you're tearing your hair out after a very short time. Now, if you put the next one up, David, further still, you see this site here. It talks about Calvin's own personal salvation. And when we're talking about Calvin personally, and we read this sort of thing, John Calvin showed no signs of being a regenerate man. He became more murderous and cruel during his rule in Geneva. He showed no inclination to be conformed to the image of Christ, as described in Scripture, for those who have been saved. It's quite amazing, isn't it? And that's there, it's on the web. These are modern writers, of course, on websites, but it's always been so. A man called Jerome Bolsec, a contemporary of Calvin, once a man of the Reformation, it seemed, but who eventually returned back to his Catholic roots, he wrote a biography of sorts of Calvin, and he refers to Calvin as ambitious, presumptuous, arrogant, cruel, evil, and vindictive. That's a quote, and much more. He says, quote, his body wasted away to death as punishment for his sins, and that he died cursing and swearing as a blasphemer. A little more up to date, there's a history of the Church of Christ by a Frenchman called Daniel Rops, written in 1955. He refers to Calvin as being a genius, but he says, and I quote, something terrible and cold, with an exterior that was cold and powerful, the perfect type of fanatic and a dictator who loved a few, if any, men. Now, what are we going to say to those sort of things? We need to redress the balance. If you put the next slide up, David. Here's somebody called Dr. William Barker, who's professor of church history at Westminster Theological Seminary, Philadelphia. And this is what he says. John Calvin has had his detractors ever since his own day in the mid-16th century, right down to the approach of the 500th anniversary of his birth in the early 21st century. But these are mostly opponents of the gospel of Jesus Christ, or people who have not taken the time to understand his writings, or, and I've underlined this, to get to know the man. Now that's what we want to do tonight. You see, Barker says that people have not taken time to get to know the man, and we need to get to know him, and possibly by getting to know him a little bit, or a little bit more, that it will prompt us to want to know even more yet. So if you put the next slide up, please, David. I want to speak about Calvin's life in three chapters. Firstly, 1509 to 1533, from his birth to his new birth when he was converted. And then a time of change, much change, in that next section to 1541. And then the last section, thirdly, 1541 to 1564, in Geneva, which of course is the city which is always associated with Calvin, the city of God on earth. Okay, next slide. So like most children, Calvin's parents wanted the best for him. They tried to ensure that in his early life and education he would lead a fruitful and wealthy adult in the future. His mother, called Jean or John, died when he was only a little boy, so it was his father, Gerard, in particular, who championed the cause of his son. And I don't think his father, Gerard Corvin, as he was known, would realize that behind the hand that he had on his son was a greater hand of a greater father who would steer Calvin's life. Gerard thought that he was steering the life of his young son, but God was behind that hand. John was born in Noyon in Picardy in France. A picture on the left-hand side there of his boyhood home. His father was a highly esteemed man in the city. He was like a solicitor, a legal man to the Roman Catholic bishop of the Cathedral of Noyon, which is a picture that you see there. So Calvin's father moved in the realms of high society, and John Calvin, as a boy, grew up among the rich and the educated and the outwardly religious. He was taught refined manners, bearing, and social graces. Prior to the Reformation, of course, the Catholic Church was in effect the only church, and there was little true godliness. There was much superstition and no evangelical gospel. As a boy, John was taken by his mother to a nearby town where there was a relic of St. Anne. It was her skull. And as a young boy, John was allowed to kiss the skull of St. Anne. And that was the type of superstition that was rife in the Catholic Church. Next slide. Here's the birthplace of Calvin in Noyon, as you can see, north of Paris. John proved to be an extremely bright boy, an intelligent boy, a very intelligent boy. And at a young age, just 14 years of age, his father was able to send him away to Paris to begin his adult studies in earnest. His father had decided that John would have a career in the church, that he would study theology. John, as a young boy, had no real convictions. He was blind to the truth of God's word, but he obliged his father by throwing himself into his studies. And because of his father's connections with the church, with the cathedral church, he had secured for John a benefice or a financial income. So even as a youngster, he was given a financial income from the cathedral of Noyon. So his position was secure amongst the rich, the wealthy, studying grammar and logic and poetry and arithmetic and theology, of course, in the University of Paris. Now, it's very interesting because in Paris, the influences on his studies were immense. Some of the best experts in Europe, and in France in particular, were to be found in Paris. A man called Mathurin Cordier taught him Latin. He was one of the great exponents of Latin in the university. He would later join Calvin in Geneva as a supporter of the Reformation, and Calvin actually dedicated one of his commentaries to him. Things were changing in the spiritual and the theological landscape of Europe at that time. And when Calvin was only 8 years old, there was sound of a hammer in Wittenberg as Martin Luther nailed up his 95 theses on the door of the church in Wittenberg. And really, that signaled the beginning of the Reformation. And Luther was only 8 years old at that time. So Calvin didn't really know much yet about Luther. In fact, the two never did meet, but Lutheran teaching was beginning to infiltrate into the university. One man called Jacques Lefebvre was to be such an influence on Calvin's best friend, William Farrell, and he was strongly instrumental in this Reformation teaching coming into the university. So it began to touch Calvin's life, but his education was well and truly steeped in Catholic dogma. Later in life, when he was looking back, this is what he said about his learning in those days. These are Calvin's own words. He says, "Mere sophistry." I had to look that up. That means deceptive reasoning. So mere sophistry, and so twisted, involved, tortuous and puzzling that scholastic theology might well be described as a kind of esoteric magic. That's a magic which is hidden to only but just the few, that's what it means. The denser the darkness in which anyone shrouded a subject, and the more he puzzled himself and others with preposterous riddles, the greater his fame for acumen and learning. Possibly you might say that in some universities that's still the case. Anyway, he achieved the equivalent to a master's degree at the age of 17, and that would only usually be awarded at the age of around 21. But then there came a sudden direction change in his life. Next slide, David. His father, for whatever reason, suddenly decided, I think financially, that he would be better off as a lawyer rather than going into the church. And so his father arranged for him to transfer to Orléans, so a little bit further south, to the university there, and to change his course and to become a lawyer, study law at Orléans University. Now, Calvin's mind was such a mind that he was able to change course and take on board such teaching. And indeed, when he found himself partway through the course, he had so understood the detail of law that he was teaching some of the younger students. Sadly, however, his theology and also his legal studies had driven him further and further down a humanistic route, mixed up with all his Catholic background and traditions, and he was far from the truth of God. But then came three very particular providences that steered him forwards. Firstly, he studied Greek. Sorry, if you go back. Firstly, he studied Greek under a man called Melchior Wulmer. He had Lutheran sympathies, and he gave Calvin a number of works by Luther, including a book called The Liberty of the Christian Man. And in that book, Luther had set out very carefully the doctrine of justification by faith. Of course, that was the central tenet, wasn't it, of Luther's understanding and his Reformation, justification by faith. And that began to have an effect upon Calvin. Second thing that happened, Calvin's cousin, called Pierre Olivetin, he came to Orléans. He was a true Christian. He had Lutheran sympathies as well, but he was quite close to his cousin. And there is no doubt that the influence of his cousin also affected Calvin. And then thirdly, during his studies, Calvin's father died. Now that was quite significant because when Calvin's father died in 1530, it was as if his hand had been taken off of Calvin's life. And the strong influence that he had was now broken. Calvin had published a legal work that it hadn't really sold. It was disappointing. And he was becoming a little disillusioned and somewhat lost as to what the next step might be. Robert Raymond writes of him, and he says, I quote, "A brilliant young scholar, possessed of one of the most thoroughly trained legal minds of his time, taught by the best authorities in all Europe, in all subjects in which he was schooled. But he was now at a crossroads. But God had brought him there." And it was probably during 1533, he would have been either 23 or 24, when God intervened in Calvin's life and his direction changed dramatically. Calvin is silent on the exact date, but we do read what he says, if you change the slide, David. This is Calvin's conversion experience, and it's actually contained in his commentary on the Book of Psalms. This is where he writes about it. It's in the preface, right at the beginning, and you can read it in here if you want to have a look at it, and there's a lot more than is here, but just this little bit here I thought would be interesting, because this is his confession of his faith, as it were. He says, "Since I was too obstinately devoted to the superstitions of popery to be easily extricated from so profound an abyss of mire, God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought my mind to a teachable frame, which was more hardened in such matters than might have been expected from one at my early period of life. Having thus received some taste and knowledge of true godliness, I was immediately inflamed with so intense a desire to make progress therein, that although I did not altogether leave off other studies, yet I pursued them with less ardour." It's interesting, isn't it, that he attributes the change exclusively to God. It doesn't refer to a preacher or anything else. He says, "God subdued my mind." And we would say he was truly born again from above. I think back of that website where the contributor said that he didn't think that Calvin was even regenerate. Well, I don't think he's read that. Okay, next one, David. So we come to the second chapter in Calvin's life, 1533 to 1541, a time of many changes. After his conversion, Calvin left Orléans and returned to Paris, where he sought out those of the Reformed cause. They were mainly Lutherans, of course. There were no Calvinists yet. So it was mainly the Lutheran influence, not so much the influence of Zwingli, because he was very much in Switzerland. Now here's another interesting connection and providence. He became a friend of a man called Nicholas Kopp. Nicholas Kopp was a Lutheran supporter who was soon to become the rector of the university in Paris. And recognizing his considerable abilities, Kopp asked Calvin if he would write for him his inaugural address. And he recognized Calvin's abilities, and so Calvin did that, and there appeared what really is Calvin's first piece of Reformation literature, although it was never really formally attributed to him. The speech basically called on the complete Reformation of the Church. As you can imagine, it was not very popular in Catholic France, and the authorities confined it to the flames, and they put out an arrest warrant for Kopp and also for Calvin, who was already under suspicion as being a supporter of Kopp's Lutheran ideals. And Calvin was a trained theologian, and he was a brilliant lawyer, but now he became a fugitive. And it is a tradition, and it's not really established whether this is the truth, but a tradition that he escaped from the city out of a window, climbing down a sheet, and dressed as a vine dresser and carrying a hoe over his shoulder. The Reformation had begun to divide Europe politically. It had done that in what we now call Germany, the different states electing either for reform or for the Catholic Church. And that was the case also in other countries like France, with certain areas or cities or certain members of the aristocracy and so on declaring for Reformation. And Calvin fled to where he thought he would be sure of support and refuge in those places. And it was at this time where he began his great work, what somebody has called his magnus opus, which is his Institutes. And this is a brand new version or copy of Calvin's Institutes. It wasn't quite as large as this when he first put it together, because he expanded it as the years went by. And of course, Calvin was writing with the trained mind of a theologian and a lawyer, but with a sanctified mind. God had saved him, and he saw God's truth with the Holy Spirit illuminating it. And it was with that mind that he began that work. That was just the beginning of that work, not yet the completion of it. Back in the early days, we mentioned he met Lefebvre. He was now an aged man. He tried to stay within the Catholic Church and reform it from within, which is what, of course, Luther sought to do, didn't he? And he never left Roman Catholicism. But having met Lefebvre again, Calvin was convinced that his route forward was to be to leave the church. So he set off back to Noyon in the north, where he'd resigned, where he resigned his benefices, and he returned to live with a friend in Paris. And of course, he was now without his financial means. He was cast upon the kindness of friends, and he was in danger of his life. And it was a time of persecution, a persecution which became even greater after something called the Placard incident. And this is quite humorous in a way, because those sympathetic with the reformers prepared placards with statements on those placards supporting the reform of the church. And during the night they went round Paris and put up these placards in prominent places, on buildings and so on throughout the city. But somebody had the temerity to put one of these placards on the bedroom door of King Francis I. Catholic Francis I. And you can imagine he reacted harshly, and he called for drastic action, and persecution became greater. Many were caught. You can read about the terrible persecution. They were whipped. Some had their tongues cut out, even burned alive as heretics. And of course, some of those men and women would have been friends of Calvin. Now, we mentioned the Institutes. The pages of what was the early version of the Institutes were written but not published. But at this time, after that persecution, in 1536, Calvin published the Institutes for the first time. And there's something quite remarkable at the front of this, and we'll put it up on the board. There is what is called a prefatory address. There is in here almost a letter to King Francis. And here's the beginning of it. To his most Christian majesty, the most mighty and illustrious monarch Francis, King of the French, his sovereign. And then Calvin writes to him, sire, or literally, dear sir. He's writing to the king in the opening of this book. And you can see what it says. When I first engaged in this work, nothing was further from my thoughts than to write what I should afterwards be presented to your majesty. My intention was only to furnish a kind of rudiments by which those who feel some interest in religion might be trained to true godliness. And I toiled at the task chiefly for the sake of my countrymen the French, multitudes of whom I perceived to be hungering and thirsting after Christ, while very few seem to have been duly imbued with even a slender knowledge of him. That this was the object which I had in view is apparent from the work itself, which is written in simple and elementary form, adapted for instruction. And he goes on, and he makes a plea. It's quite a lengthy address, and it's in here, to the king on behalf of those subjects of King Francis who had been converted and who had come to see and understand the doctrines of grace and so on, come to true faith in Christ, and who had sided with reformers. And it's a plea not to deal with his subjects in such a way. His plea was for justice for those who were being persecuted in this terrible way that we've mentioned earlier. And he sets out the theology of the reformers in the context of the political situation of the day. It was an extremely brave, amazing thing for him to do. I've got a quote here from a professor of church history at Yale University. He says about this, about the Institutes, it was not merely a handbook of theology which marked its young author as the ablest interpreter of Christian doctrine that the Reformation age had produced, but it was prefaced by a bold yet dignified and respectful letter addressed to King Francis, which at once placed Calvin at the head of the French reformers and revealed him in the highest degree as a man of leadership. And we have to remember he was only 26 years old, which is the most remarkable thing. Okay, next slide then. We're gradually putting more cities on here. Just before its publication in 1535, Calvin had to flee. He fled under assumed name Martin Lucanius to Basel. And then to Geneva. He intended to stay only one night. He had undertaken this long detour because he was going to Strasbourg. And if you follow that, it doesn't make a lot of sense as to why he went that great long detour around. But there was a war being waged by Francis, King of France, with Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor. And so to get to Strasbourg, where he intended to go, where Calvin intended just to dedicate his life to a life of writing and study, he went to Geneva. Isn't that amazing that God even put a war in place so that Calvin should go to Geneva? Now, somebody else comes on the scene in Geneva in that one day that Calvin expected to stay there. And he's coming up. William Farrell has a connection with our Sunday ministry, called the Elijah of the Reformation. He stands next to this man who became his great friend in stone, we saw at the beginning. Farrell was a fearless and faithful preacher and pastor in Geneva, and he'd heard all about Calvin. Having heard that Calvin had arrived in the city, he found out where he was, he paid him a visit, and Calvin was completely overawed by this man. And I don't know where this actually is, but you can see he's a bit of an overawing looking man, isn't he? Quite what he's doing with the Bible or whatever he's got there, I'm not quite sure, but it gives you the impression of the man. And Calvin tells us about this man. He was 20 years his senior, and this is what he says. Farrell, who burned with extraordinary zeal to advance the gospel, immediately strained every nerve to detain me. And after he had learned that my heart was set upon devoting myself to private studies, and finding that entreaties were in vain, he went on to say that God would curse my retirement and the piece of study that I sought if I withdrew and refused him help when the need for it was so urgent. I was so terror-stricken that I abandoned the journey I had planned, but I was so sensible or so aware of my natural shyness and timidity that I would not buy myself to accept any particular office. Well, he did accept the office eventually as pastor of minister in the city. Isn't that amazing as well? Here he was passing through Geneva. Farrell had heard of him. He waylaid him. And he so struck terror in his heart that Calvin couldn't move on. So began his first period. Just under two years in Geneva. You could say that he was pressed into the city by Farrell. But interestingly, not long later, both of them were thrown out of the city by the authorities. Now, at this stage, we just need to pause for a minute and to talk a bit about Geneva and what it was like. So, next one. Geneva was run as an independent, autonomous city. Its religious life was dominated. Its religious life dominated every other aspect of life. There was possibly sort of 15,000 or so inhabitants, and this is the ruling hierarchy. Somebody's called this Geneva's Byzantine factional politics. It's a bit complicated. We need perhaps to understand it a little bit, because otherwise it doesn't make sense what happens to Calvin and Farel. There was a general council. It was quite feudal. This was made up of the heads of the larger families. It met twice a year. Then there was a council of 200 under that, and then a council of 60, which didn't seem to have any relevance at all, really. They were all members of the council of 200, so why they had to meet, I'm not quite sure. Nobody else can really explain it. But then there was the council of 25, which was called the Little Council. The Little Council. And in effect, they ruled the city. They sat three times a week. And within the city, which had as its spiritual hub the cathedral, and if we put the next slide up, you'll see it's not a very good picture, but you can see that's a skyline of the city and how large the cathedral is, how it dominates the city. That really is symptomatic, if you like, of the way the city ran. The city had declared for the Reformation. The cathedral was the largest building in the city. And there was a dominance of religious life, therefore, in the city. The city councillors had declared for the Reformation, and the pastors in the city were extremely influential in city life. But not all were happy with the strict biblical standards of Farel and, of course, of Calvin, as Farel had pressed him into this role as a pastor in the city. And there were opponents of his strict morality, of his biblical standards. They were known as libertines. They wanted a less strict moral and ethical rule of life. And there was an element of conflict. And that conflict came when the Little Council sought to impose its will in church matters. And it's extremely difficult to understand where church matters began and civil matters ended and vice versa. But they wanted to be involved in church discipline matters and issues such as who came to the Lord's table and so on. And Calvin and Farel insisted that the church alone should have oversight over matters concerning the church. Calvin had published a document called Articles for the Organization of the Church and Its Worship. He'd formulated a structure for the church based on New Testament principles, and he was to eventually bring that to be in Geneva, but not yet. The Little Council would not accept that. They wouldn't accept the stance of the reformers, and they unceremoniously dismissed them from the city and from their roles, and they left on the 25th of April 1538. Calvin went to Strasbourg, which is where he'd intended to go, if you remember, and Farel to Neuchâtel, where he pastored a church until his death in 1565. But we're not done with Farel quite yet. He comes back into the story in a little while. Calvin was disappointed. His dream, his vision of a city of God on earth was dashed. Remember, he was still only 28 years old, and just under 3.5 years later he would return. Things would be very different. But in God's providence, the years in Strasbourg were not wasted. Here he became the pastor of a church where there were 500 people. And here he developed his church structure and his organization and his thinking further. He was able to refine it, and it was invaluable to do that for his return to Geneva. It was here in Strasbourg he published a book of psalms and hymns. We have one of those hymns in the hymn book, which we'll sing when we finish. He published his first Bible commentary, and that's here on Romans, his first Bible commentary. And he spent time revising and republishing his institutes, and he got married. Somebody said that Calvin was not a great wooer of women. He'd written down his criteria for a wife. So those of you who are looking for a wife, I don't know whether you've done that, but he actually commissioned Farel and another of the great names from the period, Martin Bucer, to find a woman that fitted his criteria, because he wasn't a great wooer of women. Here are his criteria. He said, "I am not one of those insane lovers who, when once smitten with the fine figure of a woman, embraces also all her faults. This is the only beauty that allures me, if she be chaste, obliging, not fastidious, economical, patient, and careful for my health." So we better see the lady. Here she is. This lady who eventually fitted the bill was a lady called Idelette de Bure, a widow from his congregation in Strasbourg. Her husband had been brought to the Reformed faith by Calvin earlier before he died. They'd had two children and they became a family. So he got married. Also in 1539, a somewhat strange providence of God brought Calvin back to the attention of the little council in Geneva. He was asked to respond to a certain Cardinal Sadoleto, who had endeavoured to persuade the Genevan council to return to the Catholic faith. His arguments were strongly reasoned, and the council had struggled to find anyone adequately to lay out a reply to the learned cardinal, to refute his claims and lay out a strong, biblically based, reformed position. And the only man that they could think of was Calvin. And they contacted him, and he duly obliged. And it was this, coupled with the gradual breakdown of law and order in Geneva, and the poor quality of the spiritual leaders that followed Calvin and Farel, that convinced them that they should invite Calvin back to return to Geneva. Question was, should he go? And this is where Farel comes back into the story. He wrote a strongly worded letter to Calvin, urging him to follow that sense of calling that had bound him to the city all through the last years. And this is what Calvin wrote back to Farel. He said, "Had I the choice at my own disposal, nothing would be less agreeable to me than to follow your advice. But when I remember that I am not my own, I offer up my heart, presented as a sacrifice to the Lord. I submit my will and my affections, subdued and held fast to the obedience of God." And that's where our title comes from. So on the 13th of September 1541, he returned to the city, and immediately to his pulpit in St. Peter's. And on the first Sunday he returned, he continued from exactly where he'd left off in his exposition when he'd left some 3.5 years before. It's quite amazing. Next one then. So we come to the last part, the third part of his life. And here now Calvin really begins his work in the city with which he's always associated. There were many struggles, particularly at the beginning of this period, but many triumphs as well. And the last 10 years saw his influence rise not only in Geneva but throughout Europe, really. Next one. I think this is a picture of the little council. The little council was far more amenable now to his strong moral standards, and they welcomed his newly formed consistory, which he brought together, which were magistrates and pastors and ministers who dealt with the rule of law in the city, spiritual and civil law. Calvin emphasized a biblical work ethic in all men and clear moral standards. He prohibited begging on the streets. He brought in many social reforms. John Knox, he came to Geneva and sat under Calvin's teaching, as you probably know, and became influenced by him in these years before returning to Scotland, and he said that this was the most perfect school of Christ that was ever on earth since the day of the apostles. Calvin oversaw the creation of a truly Protestant Reformed church, with the church alone deciding on matters of regulation and discipline, its government, in practice of oversight and rule and baptism, was Presbyterian. But it was to become the basis for churches right across Europe and into America as time went by, even after Calvin's death, long after Calvin's death. Calvin actually had four office bearers in the church: pastors to preach and administer the sacraments, doctors to teach, elders to admonish those who they saw were at fault and leading a disorderly life, and deacons to watch over the poor and the sick. Whilst not being involved in the actual production of the Geneva Bible, certainly had a tremendous influence in that, and that became the main Protestant version throughout Europe, and even in this country before the Authorized Version in 1611. He founded the Geneva Academy, which became the first Protestant university in the world. He was its senior professor of theology, and Theodore Beza, who stands next to him in that statue, became a leading figure also. Beza wrote a life story of Calvin very soon after Calvin had died. Many men like Knox, Miles Coverdale, John Fox, who wrote Fox's Book of Martyrs, they came to Geneva mainly because of persecution at home. Some names that we don't know so well, men influenced by Calvin, trained and then sent out through Europe as pastors and teachers of the Reformed school. And one could say that the birthplace of English and American Puritanism was here in Geneva at this time. The output of Calvin is phenomenal. If you put up the next one, here is Calvin preaching. Here's the church as it is today, St. Peter's Church. Here is Calvin preaching to the crowd in the church. He preached over 4,000 sermons, and amazingly, 2,000 of those sermons are preserved, all through the work of one man, a man called Denis Raguier. He took them down in a form of shorthand and then transposed them into written form. So half of the sermons that Calvin preached in St. Peter's have been preserved for us today. Next one, David. He wrote many commentaries. Here he is with his books. Almost every book of the Bible, not all of them, but almost every book, and some extensively. Jeremiah and Lamentations, for example, run into 5 volumes. Somebody very kindly gave me the complete set, 45 volumes of Calvin's commentaries. He wrote catechisms, confessions of faith, treatises on various theological subjects and debates, exposures of things like the veneration of relics. He'd been taken as a young boy to kiss the skull of St. Anne, and he condemned those things and exposed them for what they were, a sham and worthless. He produced counter material to the Council of Trent, which was an attempt by leading scholars of the Catholic school to go back to the old days, as it were. He wrote letters. He wrote 4,271 letters that we know about, including 163 to his great friend Farrell. And I think the Banner of Truth have just published a volume of many of his letters. And many of these letters are to heads of state and kings and church leaders, and they're substantial items. And then his institutes were republished in its final version. Robert Raymond said he was a master exegete and a wholesale plagiarist of scripture. In other words, he sucked scripture into everything that he did. And you can see that when you read his books and his works. There's no doubt that Calvin succeeded Luther in becoming the major leader of the Reformation from that time. There were times of great sadness. His wife, Videlette, bore him a son, Jacques, in 1542, but tragically he died after only a few days. And it's touching what Calvin said at the time. He said this: "The Lord has certainly inflicted a severe and bitter wound in the death of our baby son, but the Lord himself is a father and knows what is good for his children." Anyone who says that Calvin had no feelings should read what he says about the loss of his son. And then also the loss of his wife. Idelette died in 1549, and Calvin was left alone for the last 15 years of his life. And this is what he says about the loss of his wife. He says, "I have been bereaved of the best companion of my life, who, for if our lot had been harsher, would have been not only the willing sharer of exile and poverty, but even of death. While she lived, she was the faithful helper of my ministry. From her I never experienced the slightest hindrance." Another example of Calvin's compassion and tenderness. And the next thing we must mention, another great sadness, which is something called the Servetus Affair. There's a book here by Robert Raymond, and he has 15 pages on this. We won't go into detail, but what happened with Servetus? Well, on 27th of October 1553, Servetus was burnt alive at the stake in Geneva, and that within the law of the city and within the knowledge and under the signature of Calvin. It was a commonly held view in those days that heretics should be exposed and put to death. The Catholics certainly practiced that. We know that, don't we, under Catholic persecution. And it's sad to say at times those who supported the Reformation of the Church, they did that too. Calvin certainly had exposed this man Servetus. He peddled serious heretical teachings, particularly concerning the Trinity and the key doctrines of the nature of God and the deity of Christ. And interestingly, it is said that if the Catholics had got to this man first, they would have put him to death. Calvin did all he could to persuade Servetus to change his stance. Way back in 1536, he first challenged him about the printing of a book which Servetus had called On the Errors of the Trinity. Calvin had sent him an early copy of his Institutes, and he urged him to read them. And at his trial, Calvin said to Servetus, and there's a picture of him here at his trial, "You know that at that time," he's referring to 17 years before, "I was ready to do everything for you, and did not even count my life too dear that I might convert you from your errors." But Servetus would not change, and sadly the time came for his sentence, and Calvin did have to finally agree, although he pleaded with the council for a different punishment. We have to see and understand this matter in the context of its time, of the overall work of Calvin and Calvin's great reluctance to take this action and all his efforts to persuade the council for some different form of punishment. But we cannot get away from it that Servetus was burnt alive at the stake. We're nearly at the end. Lastly, we need to see Calvin's great work, this last part of his life, in the light of his rapidly failing health. There's a spelling mistake there. It says, "Whilst living here, his health began to fail quite seriously." This is where Calvin lived. A translation of what's on the left-hand side is on the right-hand side. The house was demolished and replaced by this memorial, and I assume those of you who've been to Geneva have probably seen that. Up until his early 30s, Calvin had been of fairly robust health, but in later life, long hours of study, poor diet, lack of exercise, the loss of his wife and his child had caused him to go downhill physically. He